Cities and states across the country will continue facing a homelessness crisis in 2020.
There are too many people looking for too few apartments, and what ensues is kind of a game of musical chairs.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for January 2nd, a look at the increasing criminalization of homelessness in the United States. Also on the podcast, a preview of the most significant foreign policy issues that the Trump administration will face in the coming year.
President Trump is learning the hard lesson that every one of his predecessors has learned. The Middle East can just suck you in, and events on the ground often, even always, overtake diplomacy.
And plus, we hear from you on the stories you want us to cover in 2020.
I would like to hear about the working poor,
climate change,
universal basic income,
healthy stories of people across the world overcoming struggles and obstacles.
We begin with homelessness in the U.S. Let's get going. I hope your 2020 is off to a good start, but many of 2019's issues aren't going anywhere. And one of those is the high rates of homelessness across the U.S. So homelessness is often viewed as a local issue, something for cities and states to tackle. But in recent years, the federal government has taken a renewed interest in addressing it, especially in Democrat-led cities.
If these Democrat-liberal politicians don't straighten out, the federal government will have to come in. We're not going to lose cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and others that are great cities. We're not going to allow that to happen to our cities.
President Trump there speaking about the issue of homelessness on a September visit to California, where the issue is especially acute. And last Saturday, the president doubled down on his criticism of how leaders in California and New York have handled homelessness in their states. In a tweet, he said California and New York must do something about their tremendous homeless problems, and added that the governors in those states should be able to take care of the issue, quote, very easily. In December, the Trump administration picked Robert Marbit as the new director for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, but advocates are concerned about Marbit's history of pushing for the criminalization of homelessness, a trend that we see playing out across the country. According to the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty Rights, about 140 cities that their group tracked have at least one law restricting camping in public. The center has also reported that a person experiencing homelessness is up to 11 times more likely to be arrested than a person with housing. And President Trump has reportedly been considering an executive order to address homelessness, though details are vague. So to help us understand the rise and the criminalization of homelessness across the country, as well as how the federal government could play a role, we're joined by two guests today. Will James is a reporter with KNKX in Seattle, Washington, and Sarah Rankin is the director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University School of Law. Will and Sarah, great to have you with us.
Hey, no problem.
Thanks so much.
Will, the big question is, why are we seeing this rise of homelessness across the United States?
Especially on the West Coast, homelessness is this glaring contradiction. You know, on the West Coast of the U.S., where we're seeing some of the most rapidly rising levels of homelessness, and the West Coast is actually, to an extent, driving some of these national increases in homelessness, the economy is sort of ascendant here at this moment. The two richest people on the planet live here in Washington State. Amazon is based here. Google and Facebook are based on the West Coast. And yet, when you drive down our highways and in our downtowns and in our wooded parks, you see thousands of people living in tents, in you know, basically modern-day shanty towns. When you look at the trend lines, the closest correlation is between the rise in homelessness and the rise in rents. When rents go up, homelessness goes up. And that can be confusing because at an individual level, you do see a lot of people experiencing homelessness with really complex problems like substance use disorders, like severe and chronic mental illness. Increasingly, childhood trauma is seen as a factor in homelessness. But the simplest explanation is that there are too many people looking for too few apartments. And what ensues is kind of a game of musical chairs where the people left without a chair when the music stops are often the poorest, the most vulnerable, people with disabilities, people with severe and chronic mental illness, and disorders like substance use disorders.
Sarah, there are differences in how, sort of alluding to what Will was just saying, and how homelessness looks depending on where you are in the United States. You've talked about invisible homelessness. Tell us where you see more of that across the country.
So most folks don't understand the difference between homelessness generally, which is for most people very temporary and is not visible to folks because of couch surfing or doubling up with family members, as opposed to what you see when you look at people who are experiencing unsheltered homelessness, who are visible in the public eye. A lot of the folks who suffer from unsheltered homelessness are also considered chronically homeless. And there's a federal definition for that. It means that people experiencing chronic homelessness have to have been homeless longer than most other people experiencing homelessness, but they also have to suffer from a documentable disabling condition that prevents them from working. So examples would be people who are suffering from severe untreated mental illness, chronic health problems, and often co-occurring disorders. Those folks tend to be the majority of folks that you see unsheltered on the street.
One of the reasons why I'm interested in looking at this topic right now is because there's sort of been an increase in the criminalization of homelessness, if you will, and particularly people sleeping in public spaces. And I want to ask you both about the Supreme Court's recent decision not to hear the case of Martin v. Boise. Will, what is this case and what does it mean for the homeless?
Martin v. Boise is a case that stems from a man who was experiencing homelessness in Boise, Idaho, more than a decade ago, who got a ticket for falling asleep in an alley while he was waiting to get in a shelter. At the time, Boise was giving away a lot of tickets to people who were illegally sleeping on sidewalks, in parks, things like that. And, you know, some lawyers picked up on it. And it became this case that went for a decade until it reached the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and ended up kind of scrambling the legal landscape for enforcing these sorts of rules all over the Western United States. The ultimate decision in Martin v. Boise that came down in late 2018, the best way to sum it up is that cities cannot punish someone for sleeping outside in places like parks or on sidewalks if there is no alternative place for them to go, like a shelter. What that did was kind of prevent a lot of cities from dealing with homelessness the way they traditionally had, which is by treating it as kind of a public safety enforcement issue by kind of moving it out of sight.
Yeah, and I would read Martin v. Boise a little differently in that I think that the holding in Martin v. Boise is that cities can't punish people for surviving in public when they have no reasonable alternative. It doesn't require cities to provide adequate shelter. It doesn't prevent cities from being able to enforce their laws in ways that allow for the protection of public health and public safety. The holding itself is actually quite narrow. The criminalization of homelessness, it's a fancy word, but basically what it means is that cities across the country have been enacting an enormous web of laws that punish people for surviving in public even when they have no reasonable alternative but to do so. So examples of anti-survival laws include laws that prohibit or severely restrict one's ability to sit, stand, ask for help, protect oneself from the elements, receive food. The act of surviving in public is so tightly regulated that people experiencing unsheltered homelessness are doomed to get caught up in the web.
But this feels very much like these are cosmetic solutions, if you will, that people in cities don't want to see the encampments. They don't want to see homelessness. Is it more about the optics of homelessness versus homelessness being a threat to public safety, Sarah?
You know, I've written a lot about the role of stereotypes and prejudices in the way that our laws and policies operate. The way that we define public health and public safety is from the perspective of housed people. So if you look at some inactivity, a common popular activity like sweeps, which major urban cities spend tens of millions of dollars doing every single year, what those are really exercises in futility. It's moving very vulnerable people from Will's neighborhood to Sarah's neighborhood. giving Will the impression that the problem has been solved when it hasn't.
Will, President Trump is expected to sign an executive order on homelessness. Some of the reporting so far that we're hearing is that this may, in fact, increase resources to police departments so that they can continue to do these sweeps, particularly on homeless encampments. You have done a lot of reporting on the West Coast on homelessness, Will. What does it look like for a police department or law enforcement to sweep a community?
I've covered a number of these events. You know, what it looks like is usually in some cases, especially in more recent years, since there's been a lot of advocacy around this, there is some forewarning. People are asked to prepare for this sweep and a date is given. So in some cases, people stay up through the night to kind of pack everything they own to try to get it together in a situation where they can move. Often when the police come, people are still scrambling to gather everything they own into, you know, a situation where they can carry it, or getting help from advocacy organizations to pack it into the back of a van or something. You see people leaving things behind in a lot of cases. In a lot of these sweeps, I've actually seen once a sort of deadline is hit, let's say the sweep happens at 9 a.m., once everyone is cleared from the site, a bulldozer comes in and kind of just crushes all of the tents and makeshift houses that people have built in the encampments. And people kind of just scatter to the wind. And often after that, you see an encampment crop up somewhere else in the same city.
Sarah, tell us about the new Trump administration pick for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, Robert Marbot.
He has a reputation among homeless rights advocates as something of a snake oil salesman. He purports to have expertise on homelessness, but his ideas really fly in the face of well-established proof of what works. He has described his approach to homelessness as a velvet hammer. He's something of a godfather of punitive approaches to homelessness. And this stems from his belief that unsheltered people choose homelessness. And that offering them food or other services actually enables them and makes them too comfortable. So he has a track history of advancing sort of mass congregate shelters and forced treatment, even though studies have shown that those sorts of approaches are harmful and ineffective. He's also pretty famously said that he believes in housing forth, which is, I suppose, his policy that unsheltered people must prove themselves worthy of housing before they can be rewarded with it. And this really flies in the face of decades of evidence that an approach called housing first actually solves homelessness. It's the most studied intervention in all of homelessness policy, and it's been proven repeatedly to be the most humane and cost-effective solution to chronic unsheltered homelessness.
Well, I want to bring this back to you as we close out the segment here, because a lot of the work you do is in Seattle. And as you mentioned, Silicon Valley is there. A lot of titans of technology and wealth are there. What are they doing to, if anything, to remedy the homeless situation in their backyards, literally? I mean, these are companies that profess to want to make the world a better place. Have they stepped in? Amazon and Microsoft and any of these folks?
Certainly, you've seen philanthropic efforts kind of emerge. Jeff Bezos, of course, the founder of Amazon, recently announced kind of an influx of money into dealing with homelessness. The Gates Foundation has dealt with this issue, certainly. But in Seattle, there was a huge fight not very long ago about an effort to impose a tax on certain corporations that would have affected Amazon and raised money specifically to respond to homelessness. Amazon fought that tax tooth and nail, and the city council ended up repealing it. So while we have seen, you know, some action on the philanthropic front, there also have been instances of these tech giants really, really resisting efforts to be taxed to solve this crisis.
Will James is a reporter with KNKX in Seattle, Washington, and Sarah Rankin is the director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University School of Law. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
Thank you.
Allah, 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 All
On Tuesday, December 31st, protesters broke into the United States Embassy in Baghdad, setting fires and breaking windows. The protests were in response to a United States airstrike in Iraq over the weekend, which killed at least 24 members of an Iranian-backed militia. The airstrike drew outrage across Iraq and condemnation of U.S. intervention in the country. And although the demonstrators dispersed on Wednesday, these protests are just the latest sign of growing unrest in Iraq in recent months. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke about the Iraq protests Tuesday on Fox News.
Well, what you saw was Iranian-backed terrorists. Many of them are individuals that have been designated terrorists by the United States and others, coming to the American embassy and posing a risk to American diplomats and personnel inside the embassy. You saw President Trump direct a quick, decisive, prudent response by making sure that we had all the resources necessary to keep our people safe and to secure the compound as well.
And just how to handle the unrest in Iraq is just one of the many significant foreign policy issues that President Trump will be facing in the new year. The United States' relationship with countries ranging from North Korea to Russia to Great Britain will all be subject to intense scrutiny in the coming months. Joining me now is Robin Wright. She's a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center and a contributor to The New Yorker. Robin, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
We'll start with the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. I mean, what led to these protests?
There have been protests in Iraq generally. This has been an increasingly unstable environment. And in that context, the U.S. struck at a pro-Iranian militia that had been attacking the United States interests and very specifically a U.S. base near Kirkuk, where one contractor and two Iraqi policemen were killed. The death of an American led for the first time to a response that targeted the militia, but implicitly also targeted Iran. This comes after months of tension separately with Iran over the striking of an oil facility in Saudi Arabia, the shooting down of an American drone over the Persian Gulf, and the attacks on tankers. So this has been a combustible environment that suddenly exploded.
Let's talk about President Trump's response to the attacks. He's alleging that this attack on the U.S. embassy was ordered from Tehran, and in a tweet, the president said, quote, "This is not a warning. It is a threat." Robin, a threat of what?
Well, that's one of the big questions. What does the United States do? I think the bigger question for the United States is whether after 17 years of war, more than $1 trillion in American treasure and more than 4,000 American lives, whether the United States is kind of losing Iraq. The demonstrators pull back from the embassy on the condition that Parliament would debate a resolution to demand that the U.S. troops withdraw from Iraq at a time that there is still an ISIS presence off in the western part of the country, carrying out attacks, waging an insurgency. So there's a lot going on, and this tension plays out in all of these flashpoints.
What have the troop levels been in Iraq, American troop levels been? Because one of the arguments against withdrawing troops and U.S. military support overall in Iraq is that it would allow for Iran to exert even more influence in the country. Is that what's happening here?
The United States has about 5,000, probably a bit more, in Iraq. The mission is to counter ISIS, and that mission has been largely successful. But Iran's influence has been growing on the ground for a very long time, and it also played an important role in countering ISIS. It had militia allies trained and aided by Iran under the Popular Mobilization Forces, more than 60 different militias in Iraq that formed together as ISIS pushed deeper into Iraq, seized a third of the country. They mobilized under the Popular Mobilization Forces that the Iraqi government, because its own army had fallen apart, an army trained by the United States, recognized as an official branch of the Iraqi military. And so that's where the conundrum is. You know, what do you do about a militia that is part now of the Iraqi government, which the Iraqi government has not fully controlled and that sometimes reflects Iran's interests more than Iraq's?
Turning to Iran for a second here, back in the summer, as you mentioned, U.S. tensions with Iran had escalated dramatically after Iran shot down a U.S. drone. The White House increased sanctions. We know that the Iran nuclear deal continues to unravel. And at the same time, in early December, the U.S. and Iran engaged in a prisoner swap. So I'm wondering, what is the relationship with these two countries following this most recent airstrike in Iraq?
An even more important question after what's happened in the last week. It's very interesting that both sides are trying to ratchet up the pressure. In the United States case, to push Iran back to the negotiating table and to give more than it did in the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran is ratcheting up the pressure because it wants to force the United States to give it a reprieve from very tough economic sanctions. Both sides at the end of the day still want diplomacy. It's just very hard to see how they get there.
President Trump is known for, or at least says, that he's not interested in meddling much in the Middle East. And his troop withdrawal from Syria, I think, was one of the biggest examples of that. Is this forcing the president, Robin, to engage in an area that he has previously said that he is not interested in doing?
Indeed, it has. And remember when he said he was going to withdraw just over a year ago from Syria, he ended up keeping most of those troops there. President Trump is learning the hard lesson that every one of his predecessors has learned. The Middle East can just suck you in, and events on the ground often, even always, overtake diplomacy. And it's very hard to resist when you're under attack, not sending in more troops. The question is, do you withdraw completely? And if you do you leave an embassy or your diplomats much more vulnerable? It's a question we also face in Afghanistan.
Speaking of that invasion in Afghanistan, peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban have been announced and then canceled and then revived once again. What is the Trump administration's strategy in Afghanistan, if we're even able to say that there is a strategy?
Well, the United States wants to broker a ceasefire with the Taliban. That's not a peace deal. It's just a ceasefire to figure out a peace deal that would probably bring the Taliban into the government in some prominent role. And you're absolutely right. The peace talks have started and stopped and started and stopped, again, largely because of attacks that the Taliban continues to carry out. This is a very volatile environment, and the president, in an election year, wants to follow through on what he promised when he became president, and that was to withdraw American troops from foreign war zones, and he's finding it very difficult to achieve.
Robin, pivoting for a moment from the situation in the Middle East, there are a couple of other areas that the president is going to have to really take a look at. North Korea. Kim Jong-un indicated that his country, however, is planning to begin new tests of missiles and nuclear weapons. What does that tell us about the Trump administration's policy with regard to North Korea?
Well, North Korea was President Trump's boldest diplomatic initiative, and he did something that no other president has been willing to do, to sit down with Kim Jong-un, one of the world's most brutal dictators. Trump at one point said they'd fallen in love with each other, and they agreed initially to denuclearize. The problem is North Korea has done nothing in terms of even defining what it sees as denuclearization and what it wants from the U.S. in exchange. Kim imposed a December 31st deadline for the moratorium on testing some of his deadliest weapons. That deadline is passed, and he has now announced that North Korea has a new strategic weapon that he intends to unveil to the world. We're not sure what that is, but it could cover a lot of different things. It's very hard to see how the diplomatic process gets started again. There's been no tangible progress on Trump's boldest initiative, and all of the leaders around the world who want something from the United States recognize that President Trump is vulnerable.
To that end, we've seen two trends, I would say, globally at least. 2019, you've written about this and we've talked about this on The Takeaway, was a year of protests around the world. At the same time, we've seen that there have been more nationalistic right-wing, ultra-right-wing movements. What does that tell us, Robin, about what that could mean for U.S. foreign policy?
Well, President Trump actually likes many of the right-wing leaders or the tough guys. That's true not just in Latin America or Europe, but you look at Duterte, the president of the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, former field marshal, now President El-Sisi in Egypt. That is not something that President Trump fears, even if it devalues the progress in democracy around the world. But it is true that there is this kind of yin and yang of politics globally, where you see both the rise of right-wing leaders elected and also the outpouring of street protests. There is greater civil resistance around the world in a wide variety of ways, over a wide variety of issues, than at any time in human history. 2019 was really a turning point. 6 countries in Latin America, several in Africa, across Europe. You saw even in France, the Yellow Vest movement. Russia, Vladimir Putin faced his own protests. South Korea, considered a very stable place. Singapore, in very unlikely places, you've seen this outpouring from Prague to Port-au-Prince, Santiago, Harare. It just this array of protests that often began over very small issues, the attacks on WhatsApp calls in Lebanon, a 4-cent price increase in a liter of gas in Tehran, the price of onions in India. There is this real turmoil over the relationship between the individual and his state or her state. And I think this is going to be a pattern that will play out in 2020 because it's unclear how governments can respond and how these challenges may escalate in other ways.
Robin Wright is a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center and a contributor to The New Yorker. Robin, thanks so much.
And Happy New Year to you.
And Happy New Year, and we made it.
And let's hope even more that we make it through the next one.
That is exactly, that's the small goals, baby steps here.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRX.
In 1994, the family drama Party of Five premiered on Fox. Starring Scott Wolf, Matthew Fox, and Neve Campbell, it told the story of five children who have to take care of themselves after their parents died in a car crash. And because it was a 90s show, its theme song sounded like what you're hearing now. Yes, the Bodines right there, pure 90s. Flash forward to today, and it probably won't surprise you to hear that the show is getting a reboot. But while the original was about a white family, the new version centers around the Mexican-American Acosta siblings. And this time, the parents are undocumented immigrants who get deported to Mexico in the season premiere.
What's the matter with this country?
Lucia, dignity, mija. Show them who we are.
They don't care who we are, papi. Don't you understand that by now?
That's Emily Tosta and Bruno Bashir in a scene from the new Party of Five. But with so few Latino stories told by Hollywood, some critics are wondering whether this new story about undocumented Latino immigrants will manage to subvert stereotypes or end up perpetuating them. Joining me now is Vanessa Erazo, film and television editor for Remezcla. Great to have you with us, Vanessa.
Thank you for having me.
So you've seen the first two episodes of the show. How is the deportation of the parents handled?
I would say it's handled sensitively. There's always the question of, are we portraying reality? Or are we kind of using other people's pain for entertainment? I think no matter how you do it, even if you do it sensitively, you're doing both of those things at the same time. So I do think it's moving. I definitely had tears in that scene. And that scene was in the trailer, so people were already reacting to how emotional it was. So I would say, yeah, it's kind of that fine line of, you know, is this appropriate to be able to benefit from people's pain constantly, particularly immigrants, but also show it in a way that's realistic and hits home for people.
You know? It's also a very timely thing to talk about. I mean, we just came out of a segment about what's happening with the southern border, the policy issues that are here in the United States. And we know under the Obama administration, deportation was the big tactic. Deterrence now is the big tactic, particularly for folks coming across. So I'm wondering if behind the scenes here at Party of Five, or at least the reboot of Party of Five, are there Latino writers, directors, people who are making sure that it's both timely, accurate, and not sort of exploitative of the issues that are at hand?
That was a big question that a lot of us who are entertainment journalists who are following the announcements of this show were worried about, because the initial announcement that came out was that the original showrunners from the original 90s version were behind this new version, who they are not Latino, they are both white. But from what I've read about the show, they made it a point. They felt that the most relevant way to tell this story now would be to include this immigration and deportation angle. So they made it a point to hire Latino writers and directors. So I even know one of the writers, actually, she's born in Colombia, came to the States when she was young. And they have Latinos from various different countries who are immigrants themselves. And also one of the director of the pilot is Rodrigo Garcia, who is the son of Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
And I'm wondering, I mean, we talked about the timeliness of this show right now. Does this have the potential, if you will, and it's almost hard to imagine that it could, but is there any potential here to change minds, given that immigration, particularly when it comes to Latino immigrants and migrants, is so politically charged right now?
It's a difficult question to answer. We would hope so. We hope that media has the ability to change minds. But I do feel that more than likely, it's a reflection of society and what is happening at the time, more than pushing forward. But it all depends on who ends up watching the show. It's on Freeform. It's a channel targeted at younger people. I'm not sure the demographics of in terms of ethnicity, who's watching. But I think it does have the possibility to open it up to people who don't have direct experience with immigrants in their everyday life.
I talked to Cristela Alonso, the comedian, Latina comedian, recently, and she had some interesting things to say about how Hollywood tends to tell the stories of undocumented immigrants. Let's take a listen.
My brother became a naturalized citizen in 2016, and it took him over 30 years. And we don't see that on TV. We see a lot of, a lot of immigration stories, you know, and they're always very serious. That's what my brother always said. You know, he's like, it makes it seem like if you're an undocumented immigrant, it's like you live in a cave and you just cry all day wondering, like, is today the day? And he's like, I also like to laugh. I also like to have fun. I love my family.
What do you think about that perspective? Because I thought that was pretty enlightening.
Yeah, it's pretty spot on, and there's hard numbers to back that up. Define American, which is a nonprofit organization, they take on a lot of issues, but one of the things they do is monitor media like TV and film and the portrayals of immigrants. And their studies that have come out show that at least half of the immigrants in the United States are citizens, but a very small percentage of immigrants shown on TV are shown to be immigrants. And also that the most common words that come up is ICE, deportation. So
crying in the cave.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, being detained. And that's not the whole picture of immigrants in the United States. That's a very small percentage. So we do see a lot of the pain and the trauma and the sorrow of being an immigrant, but not, just like Cristela said, not the joy and not the everyday life, which is most immigrants in the United States aren't living that experience.
And, you know, more broadly, I mean, we've talked a lot about reboots and remakes here on the show and switching from a predominantly white cast to a Latino cast. We've seen it in One Day at a Time, Charmed, Magnum P.I. We're all rebooted with Latino leads. Are TV executives relying too much on these older formats? And should they really be focusing on just telling more original stories about Latinos? Or do those just not tend to do as well?
In my opinion, I would prefer to see more original stories, but I do think it's actually a symptom of a problem of the lack of representation in Latinos. Most of the shows we see coming out right now that are new with all Latino casts are reboots. And it's not that their other shows aren't being pitched, pilots aren't being written, it's just that they're not getting picked up. So the shows that executives are greenlighting already have an existing show or name, or, you know, One Day at a Time has Norman Lear attached. This was one of the biggest hits of the 90s. So an executive has something that they can tie it to that shows past success. But what they're tying it to rarely involves Latinos.
Is there anything now that's come out about undocumented immigrants that has made an impact on you recently?
I believe the show Superstore, which is a comedy, has done a really great job of showing that, you know, it's not the good immigrant. It's not, he's not a perfect person. It came out very slowly that he was undocumented, but you get to laugh. And also, you know, he does get detained, so it's upsetting, but they are able to tie in a lot of just making you feel good and seeing what his life is really like.
All right, Superstore. Vanessa Erasso is the film and television editor for Remezcla. Vanessa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, we've been hearing from you on the stories that you want us to cover in 2020. You've taken the mic and you're telling us what you want to hear.
Hi, this is Alex from South Weber, Utah. A question I have that the takeaway could cover is how a universal basic income would affect smaller communities and police minority relations. Also, what people in towns are doing right now in response to global warming.
This is Donna Ross calling from Frisco, Texas. Primarily climate change and where our representatives and aspiring presidents stand. How will they get their plan through a recalcitrant Senate?
This is Omar from Fort Lauderdale. I would like to hear healthy stories of people across the world overcoming struggles and obstacles for 2020. Here's looking to a brighter future for 2020.
This is Angela from Charlotte, North Carolina. I would like to hear about the working poor and people who are working and trying to avoid homelessness or living in their cars. I am concerned about this issue, and if you are homeless without a permanent place to stay, can you register to vote?
You can keep calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. Happy 2020, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Walter, and I'm the host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, we get behind the chaotic headlines from Washington and tell you how policies in this country are actually changing.
You're going to see access to health care determined by where you live.
Tribalism works.
There is a crisis of institutional decay.
Money follows power. Join me each week on Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway,